Hello, fellow law nerds. Welcome to another episode of Boom Lawyered, a Rewired.News podcast hosted by the legal journalism team that is super freaking stoked that the United States won the Women's World Cup. I'm Imani Gandhi.
Yay! And I'm Jess Piclow. Rewire.news is dedicated to bringing you the best reproductive rights and social justice news, commentary, and analysis on the web. And the Team Legal podcast is part of that mission. So a big thank you to our subscribers and a welcome to our new listeners.
Advocates recently filed a lawsuit challenging a Georgia law that would ban abortion at around 6 weeks. The case is called Sister Song versus Kemp, and it's a really, really big deal. Not just because the Georgia law is ridiculous and should be blocked, but because this lawsuit specifically centers Black women in the legal challenge. In this episode, we're going to tell you all about the case and how it could introduce the concept of reproductive justice to Supreme Court jurisprudence.
Okay, Imani, so where should we begin?
Reproductive justice. Let's begin there.
Woo! Nice. Okay. I love all this World Cup enthusiasm that we're bringing into this next episode. Seriously, Imani caught World Cup fever, and it feels like one of the greatest accomplishments of our professional working together. I feel so proud. But enough of that. Reproductive justice. We expect most of our listeners to know what reproductive justice, or RJ, is. But in case you don't, let's cover it real quick. Reproductive justice centers three interconnected human rights values. Those are, one, the right not to have children, and that's using safe birth control, abortion, or abstinence. Two, the right to have children and under the conditions that we choose. And three, the right to parent the children that we have in safe and healthy environments.
Black women coined the term in 1994 as a reaction to the mainstream reproductive rights movement. The mainstream reproductive rights movement was focused primarily on the legal right to abortion, the legal right to contraception, and it failed to take into account the experiences of women of color. So reproductive justice actually centers the lives of communities of color instead of the lives of middle-class white people who had basically been battling on both sides of the abortion debate for years, right?
Yep.
So reproductive justice also recognizes that the sort of pro-choice, pro-life dichotomy wasn't particularly adequate, and it failed to account for the lived experiences of women of color. So it's important to recognize that reproductive justice is not just a new name for pro-choice politics.
Right.
It's actually a new framework. And it's a framework that's based on human rights. And actually, if I'm going to quote the introduction of a really, really key book called Radical Reproductive Justice, Foundation, Theory, Practice, and Critique. It's a book that was edited by Loretta Ross, who is basically the mother of reproductive justice, and includes essays from people like Dorothy Roberts, who is an amazing professor who wrote this book called Killing the Black Body, which you should absolutely buy and read. Please read it. And it also includes essays from quote-unquote pro-life feminists. These are feminists who don't necessarily support or quote-unquote believe in abortion, but who approach that from a reproductive justice framework rather than a Christian evangelical framework.
Mm-hmm. Imani talks about this book all the time. Seriously, go read it. It is fantastic. We have a shared library, and it's in our shared library.
Yes. We have a work spouse library in Kindle, and it really cements our relationship.
We're Amazon married.
We're bound together forever in books. And so here's a quote from that book. It's a framework based on the, quote, human right to make personal decisions about one's life and the obligation of government and society to ensure that conditions are suitable for implementing one's decision. And so this has a lot to do with what Jess and I will call positive rights versus negative rights, right? Like legal rights versus human rights. And reproductive justice is all about human rights, not as much concerned with legal rights, because as we are seeing now with the Trump administration, legal rights and human rights don't often meet. They don't often mesh in the way that they should. And so reproductive justice tries to ensure that we are focused on human rights, the human right to control one's body, the human right to control one's reproduction.
Yep.
And in addition, reproductive justice is basically a way for women of color to center themselves in this conversation and to lead this movement that demands reproductive autonomy using a human rights lens and using a lens that incorporates everyone and involves everyone.
That was a really helpful primer. I hope listeners go back and revisit it if they are ever feeling fuzzy at all on the concept of RJ. So let's talk about this lawsuit that's using this reproductive justice frame, Sister Song versus Kemp.
This lawsuit, Jess, is a breath of goddamn fresh air.
Hallelujah.
I mean, I read this and like my heart got full. I honestly teared up a little bit because it's just, it approaches this fight that we've been having about abortion rights in this new way from this RJ framework. And all you have to do is read the very first footnote to know that this lawsuit is going to be something different than anything you've ever seen before. So here's what that footnote says. Quote, plaintiffs use woman or women as shorthand for people who are or may become pregnant. But people of all gender identities, including transgender men and gender diverse individuals, may also become pregnant and seek abortion services and would also thus irreparably be harmed under HB 481.
Amani, shut the front door!
I know, right? Like, in the very first footnote, we're talking about pregnant people. We're talking about gender non-binary people. We're talking about the fact that it's not only women who get pregnant. And I have to say, you know, I've been sort of talking about this a lot on Twitter and trying to encourage people to use more inclusive language. And I don't want to be sanctimonious about it because it wasn't until 2 or 3 years ago that I began using this language. So It's not like Jess and I are more enlightened than you or know more than you. It's just that we made a decision that we were going to use this terminology. And so the fact that that terminology has now made it into a lawsuit that will probably make it to the Supreme Court, is such a big deal.
It is. Really, advocates pushing for this framing is huge. But so let's get more into it. So the lawsuit is a challenge to HB 481, also called Living Infants Fairness and Equality, the Life Act. This is when we do the...
Yep. Cue fart noise. Jesus.
So, and which Governor Brian Kemp, who essentially stole the election from Stacey Abrams, we will never stop reminding listeners of that,
never,
signed into law earlier this year.
Like, let's just take a step back and talk about how truly awful Brian Kemp is. We did a podcast, I believe, about all of the voting rights shenanigans that were going on during the November 2018 elections. This man essentially stole the election. He was in control. He was in charge of overseeing the election that he was running in. And it led to all kinds of voter suppression, of course, of Black voters and other reliably Democratic voters. So the very fact that he was in office to sign this horseshit law, it really grinds my gears, if I may use an old-timey terminology.
Exactly. And I mean, part of the fallout of that stolen election is having this bill signed into law. So let's talk about it. HB 41 bans abortion after a quote-unquote heartbeat is detected, which is usually happens around 6 weeks of pregnancy. Now, most people don't know that they are pregnant at that time. I sure as hell didn't when I was pregnant with my second child. That's basically about 2 weeks after a missed period.
We should talk for a moment about how these bills are just bullshit, right? We've discussed this before. Our research assassin, Bree Shea, and I, we wrote an article about these quote-unquote heartbeat bans. And I think I just want to reiterate that the language of the law is scientifically inaccurate.
Yep.
At 6 weeks, an embryo does not have a heartbeat. In fact, there's no cardiovascular system of any kind. What the heartbeat, the quote unquote heartbeat that these folks are talking about in a 6 week embryo is a group of cells with electrical activity. That's all that it is, right? But heartbeat is so much more provocative. And so that's the language that anti-choice advocates and legislators have settled on.
They can't call it a fetal cardiac pole ban.
No, like, it doesn't really
fetal
sound.
Fetal cardiac pole activity ban.
People be like, what the fuck is a fetal cardiac pole?
That doesn't have the same sort of swagger to it.
Exactly.
And I mean, we've talked about heartbeat bans in previous episodes, but Georgia's is slightly different, right, Imani? Maybe you should explain.
Because Black women! Hooray! like I just peel back the curtain. When we write these scripts, a lot of times we'll just use fillers like yada yada, you know, we'll make sure to go off and riff on this topic. So literally in the script, I wrote Black women, hooray, yada yada. So if we ever have swag,
we're going to put it on a mug
or merch. I'm going to put that on a mug. It's just going to say Black women, hooray, yada yada. But what's so key about this lawsuit is that, first of all, the lead plaintiff is Sister Song. And Sister Song is a reproductive justice collective. It was founded essentially by the mother of reproductive justice, and they joined with lots of other reproductive justice organizations that are focused on women of color, Latina women, indigenous women, what have you. So they're the lead plaintiff. There are a couple of providers that are also plaintiffs, and then there are three professors, all of whom are women, from Emory University, which is in Atlanta. They are also plaintiffs. So this lawsuit was filed by the ACLU, and naming Sister Song as the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit is huge and sends a message. First of all, Sister Song, as I said, is the reproductive justice collective, and they're the ones who have been attacking reproductive autonomy and attacking the ways in which the government is trying to steal from us and control our reproductive autonomy from this reproductive justice lens. It's just, it's an amazing organization. Mm-hmm. Monica Simpson is currently the executive director of it, but it was founded by Loretta Ross. Both of them are brilliant women. Like, too, I mean, it might be weird to have reproductive justice activists as your heroes, but those two women are two of my heroes. And I talked to Monica Simpson last week, and I asked her about this lawsuit and how she felt about it and whether or not she thought that it was intentional that her organization, Sister Song, was named lead plaintiff. And she said, yes, she believed it was absolutely intentional. She said that Georgia is this hub of social justice activity. Not just Sister Song is there, but there are scores of other RJ organizations that are located in Atlanta. And essentially, this lawsuit is an effort to approach abortion rights from a more intersectional lens. It's a way to approach the abortion rights fight from a proactive sort of posture as opposed to a reactive posture. Because so much of what abortion rights advocates do, and so much of what we as legal journalists covering this fight do, is react to the shit that is being thrown at us, right? We react to all of these horrible restrictions and laws that are being thrown at us, rather than trying to come up with a way that is proactive, that allows us to get in front of the fight. But, you know, I could go on and gush about Sister Song for an hour, so let me just stop right now. I love you, Monica and Loretta. Thank you for everything that you do. But let's get into what this lawsuit is actually about. So, Jess, hit me with some facts.
Okay, so as I said earlier, the lawsuit challenges the so-called LIFE Act, which says it shall be the policy of the state of Georgia to recognize the presence of a fetal heartbeat at the point of fetal viability, creating a compelling state interest to protect, quote, the independent essence of the second life, end quote,
wow,
as a, quote, object of state protection, end wow, quote, from abortion. And it shall be the policy of the state of Georgia to recognize unborn children as natural persons.
There's so much horrific language in that one little bit that it's really hard for me to...
I just had to back away from the mic. I was so upset.
The independent essence of the second life? What are you talking about? Like, we can talk
That's
about...
That's some Goop-style shit right there.
What the fuck? The independent essence? I'm sorry. I don't know of any fetuses that are able to independently grow themselves. But maybe, I don't know, maybe I've just not been watching the right science fiction movies. And also calling it an object of state protection. Why are we referring to people as objects? And furthermore, if you're quote unquote pro-life, why are you referring to this preborn, unborn, you know, baby-born child as an object of state protection? Baby Bjorn. It's a baby Bjorn child. I mean... It's just nasty. And it's a way to get around yep. Supreme Court jurisprudence, right? Because the Supreme Court has said in Roe v. Wade that a fetus is not a person. So if a fetus is not a person, a six-week embryo with fetal heart pull cardiac activity is also not a person.
So that was, we gave a lot of law there. Let's really break it down and explain for listeners what it does. So first of all, it gives fertilized eggs, blastocysts, embryos, and fetuses that have not attained viability yet the status of a class of living distinct persons that deserve full legal recognition. So there's some of your fetal personhood right there.
Indeed. The bill also amends state law to define, quote, natural person to mean, quote, any human being, including an unborn child.
Get this. The bill also includes embryos and fetuses in state population-based determinations. What?
I mean, so this is a census thing, right? We've been talking about, yeah. we did an episode about the census. There's fighting going on right now about the census. Apparently, Steve Ducey is now a Supreme Court justice and seems to know more about the census than the Supreme Court does. But we're now going to start including embryos and fetuses as part of the population for population-based determinations for things like representation and taxes and shit. Really?
But not brown people.
But not brown people, because brown people aren't really people. The bill also amends the state tax code to redefine dependent to allow a fetus at any stage of development to qualify as a dependent minor.
Accountants are going to have their hands with this. That's just all I'm going to say right there.
It doesn't even make any sense. What happens if you're pregnant and then you have a miscarriage or some sort of pregnancy loss?
Yeah.
It's just, ugh.
I mean, that's the beginning of it. But yes, yes, yeah.
This is essentially a backdoor to personhood, right? Georgia has granted personhood to so-called unborn children from the moment of fertilization. And they did this without having to go through this messy constitutional amendment process, which is what Alabama had to do last year in order to introduce personhood into that state.
Uh-huh.
So this isn't the first six-week ban lawsuit, right? There have been many others. So why are we making such a big deal about this one, Jess?
You're absolutely right, Imani. This is not the first one. Laws like Georgia's are not novel, and neither are the lawsuits challenging them. In fact, they go back years. In 2013, both Arkansas and North Dakota passed six-week bans that were permanently blocked by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Iowa's six-week ban was blocked in state court in January. A federal court recently blocked Kentucky's six-week ban, and even more recently, Ohio's six-week ban. Everybody's got this six-week ban frenzy right now.
Mm-hmm.
We expect Georgia's law will similarly be struck down. So in that respect, you're absolutely right. This lawsuit may seem unremarkable.
So why are we so excited about this lawsuit in particular? Let me go ahead and answer my own question. Because it is the first lawsuit to specifically center Black women, and it is the first lawsuit to center Black women using an RJ lens. The lawsuit highlights how the attacks on abortion rights in Georgia will hit Black women the hardest, and it emphasizes how difficult childbirth in Georgia is for Black women. And frankly, that's just amazing. This idea that we're going to center Black women in a conversation about abortion rights in a way that we never have before is truly groundbreaking.
It really is. Like, I can't stress that enough. I mean, you and I were both scratching our heads trying to figure out if any other lawsuit that we could think of has focused on Black women or other women of color in this way.
We did. And I remember asking you, and you were all, yeah, I ran 5 miles while thinking about it. And I was like, you did what? Like, were you being chased? Why were you running 5 miles? Because I was sitting my Black ass on the couch and I was thinking about it. But we both came to the same conclusion, and that this is the first lawsuit that centers Black women and other women of color. A lot of other lawsuits will talk about how these laws will disproportionately harm women of color, but there's never a focus on it. Black women have never been the focal point of a lawsuit. So
they talk around race,
right,
but not to race.
Exactly, exactly. And so listen to this quote. Listen to this fire quote. Georgians face a critical shortage of reproductive health care providers, including obstetrician gynecologists, and the rate at which Georgians, particularly Black Georgians, die from pregnancy-related causes is among the highest in the nation.
Ooh, I mean, that is like, people gotta, I mean, non-lawyers probably are like, what? You know, that's super exciting, but that's spicy
it's
in a complaint.
So spicy.
That is like hot and sexy legal language right there. Here. I've got another one. Georgians face one of the highest risks of pregnancy-related deaths in the nation, and pregnancy is 3 times as deadly for Black Georgians as it is for white Georgians.
Here's another one. I got one for you. Rather than working to end preventable deaths, and rather than honoring Georgians' reproductive health care decisions, the legislature has instead chosen to criminalize abortion from the earliest stages of pregnancy.
So this is amazing legal pleading. And I just want to talk for like a second about the art of legal writing here and the rhetoric. Because when you start with the subject of the lawsuit, effectively as Black women, and women as shorthand for Black people and people of color in the state who can become pregnant, and then you set out from the very beginning as your factual allegations These populations suffer the hardest when their rights are restricted in this fashion, and lawmakers are just flat out fucking ignoring them, is basically a summary of that last point. That, from a pleading standpoint, is really powerful because you have not said, oh, this is necessary. I mean, look, they're all attacks on constitutional rights. That's all very important. But we are, this is the difference between, as Imani was talking about, an abortion rights focused and a reproductive justice focused framing for the lawsuit. This isn't just about a constitutional right. This is about the lives of Georgians who are at stake. And they make no bones about it from the beginning. And it gives me chills.
So as you can see, we are very excited about this lawsuit. And I don't know, hopefully our energy, maybe it's the World Cup energy that we're bringing, I'm not sure, but hopefully this energy will excite you too. And I'm going to tweet out the complaint because it's a long one, but it's really worth reading to sort of understand the direction that we're going in terms of focusing these legal fights on reproductive justice. And so,
yes,
this law is a part of a nationwide assault on abortion rights. I mean, Jessica just listed off, several six-week bans and lawsuits related to six-week bans. And anti-choicer's sort of salt-the-earth strategy goes way beyond just outlawing abortion. It could also criminalize miscarriage and also criminalize some forms of birth control. And by passing laws that are flatly unconstitutional under both Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, anti-choice legislators are trying to provide a test case for the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yep.
And they're hoping that one of these test cases, and there are so many that are percolating right now. I mean, it's just the number of cases percolating right now is obscene. But they're hoping that the conservative majority on the court will gut both Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And if that happens, pregnant people's right to reproductive autonomy will then end up being determined by a patchwork of state laws. And that's never a good thing.
Precisely. I wrote about this last week. I mean, and we've talked about this on the podcast. This isn't a hypothetical threat. The call is coming from inside the House, right? Clarence Thomas is champing at the bit to gut Roe and spent a fair amount of time this term complaining that the court hasn't yet undone abortion rights.
And he also spent a fair amount of time complaining about the key judicial principle that should essentially force the court to not gut Roe versus Wade. And that's stare decisis, right? That's precedent. Yep. It's this principle that if you said shit in the past, you should follow the shit that you said in the past. I mean, that's really...
Put that on your bar exam this summer.
Exactly. I was about to say, if you have a con law final, maybe next year, just go ahead and write that down when the professor asks you what stare decisis is. But he's complained about it in multiple cases. Jess, as Jess just said, she wrote a piece about it. And it's clear that this is what he wants. And, you know, the reason that this, I hope this lawsuit is the case that he ends up having to write the opinion on, because for him, a black man having to write an opinion in a case that centers black women, and for him to turn his back on black women and to essentially say, I don't give a shit that black Georgians are dying when they give birth, it's really going to just, it's going to put a pin in this moment, and it's really going to make clear what Clarence Thomas's legacy is and has been, and that is and has been to not really give a shit about black people. I'm just...
I wish I could screenshot or could have a screenshot of my face when you were just talking there, because it like...
It's
see it and it hurts.
But one thing that is critical about this lawsuit is that it may be a vehicle finally for black women to have a national conversation about reproductive autonomy as it pertains specifically to us, right?
Ooh, say more about that.
Okay, so if you follow me on Twitter, you've been following my writing, you know one of my biggest pet peeves is the way in which anti-choicers use black women and use black women's bodies as pawns in their weaponized fight against abortion, right? They'll accuse black women of perpetrating a black genocide, right? They are essentially accusing us of trying to exterminate our own people. They will falsely accuse Planned Parenthood of erecting clinics in all black neighborhoods so that, you know, if you're a black woman and you can walk outside, there's a Planned Parenthood to your left and a Planned Parenthood to your right. Look under your couch. There's probably a Planned Parenthood clinic under your couch if you're a black woman. I mean, that's how obsessed these aunties are with Planned Parenthood and this claim that Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, wanted to use abortion to exterminate black people, which is horseshit, which you know is horseshit because I've told you a million times that it's horseshit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, despite all of these ridiculous paternalistic claims about Black women's reproduction, we have always understood reproductive coercion because this country was built from the wombs of Black women.
Okay, so you say this quite a bit. We've been friends for a long time. We've had these conversations, but I don't know that people totally understand just how dead serious you are by those statements. What do you mean? Like, this is real.
Yeah, it's absolutely real. When I say that this country was built from the wombs of Black women, I'm being literal. Literal. This country was literally built from the wombs of our people, of my people. I won't say our people because you're white, Jess. I'm sorry. But
it's okay. Nobody's perfect, Imani.
But, you know, domestic slave breeding, which is absolutely as dehumanizing as it sounds, was very, very widespread during slavery. Domestic slave breeding became particularly widespread as the transatlantic slave trade was dwindling, right? So slavery, you're going to Africa, you're going to these places, you're grabbing up people, you're yoking them up, you're putting them on ships, and you're sending them across the Atlantic. That became sort of disfavored as slavery entered its like 200, 300, 400th year. And they already had this sort of crop of Black women that were enslaved in this country. And so they began to use them for breeding purposes. They began to use Black women's bodies as they would use an animal's. They would, you know, put Black men and Black women together, enslave Black men and Black women, and essentially force them to have children. Slave owners would routinely rape their enslaved Black women, bear children with their enslaved Black women, and then sell those children into slavery. Thomas Jefferson did it. Mm-hmm. Which is why I get really, really irritated when people try to talk about this sort of, oh, this love story between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, as if Sally Hemings had any choice or consent to the life that she was consigned to. Sure, maybe she made the most of her situation, but she was routinely raped by one of the founding fathers of this country. And it really, really irritates me that we don't talk about that enough, or that when we do talk about it, we try to romanticize it as if it was some Loving v. Virginia kind of situation when it was routine, repeated rape. Ugh. And so, you know, Black women were seen as animals. We weren't viewed as humans. Mm-hmm. And so our worth as semi-humans, I guess, was determined by our fertility. The more fertile Black women were, the more valuable we were. The more sort of prestigious the slave owner was, right? You've got this crop of women, this crop of brood mares that you're using to create more slaves to work on your plantations. It's disgusting. But if you think about being an enslaved woman in that situation, if you think about having children and having those children literally ripped from your arms, you can imagine what it was Black women did in order to prevent that shit from happening. And that included turning to herbal abortifacients. Mm-hmm. That included other DIY methods of abortion, you know, falling downstairs on purpose, having people punch you in the stomach, all of these horrible self-harm type of things that Black women would do to avoid this fate that they had been consigned to. And it also included self-harm. It was not uncommon for, you know, Black women who were on the Middle Passage, who were, you know, on those ships across the Atlantic, to throw themselves overboard. Because frequently, here's how it went down. A lot of the Black men, they would be chained up in these ships. Black women were frequently not chained up because the people on the ships, the people running the ships, wanted to rape them. That's literally what happened. So when they were unchained, if they could find a chance, they would literally throw themselves overboard. They would rather drown than be sent to America to work for free for white people. If they had a child, they would often kill their newborn because they would rather kill their own child, commit infanticide, than to see that child be sold to white people to be enslaved. So we're talking about a horrific period of time during which Black women had literally no control over their reproduction.
And so fast forward to this lawsuit now and having that history, knowing that history and understanding that attacks on abortion rights are attacks on reproductive autonomy, and they are effectively the state flexing its muscle, determining who gets to have a child, when they get to have a child, and under what circumstances they get to have a child, right? The very inverse of principles of RJ. And the fact that we have Black women women in particular, people of color centered in this lawsuit, is one of the reasons, the primary reasons why Imani and I have been shouting about it for about 20 minutes now, because it is not just important, but it is powerful as hell.
It is. It absolutely is. And one of the things that Jess and I have been discussing, and I actually talked about this with Monica, is Monica Simpson, who is the current head of Sister Song, the lead plaintiff in this case, is the ways in which the comparisons between abortion and slavery are both apt and inapt, right? They're inapt. You get a lot of anti-choicers who say, oh, well, abortion is just like slavery. And, you know, slavery was legal for a while and we were able to abolish it. So we should abolish abortion. Just because abortion is legal right now doesn't mean it's morally correct. And so these sorts of arguments just strip Black women of their agency, and it removes enslaved Black women's experience from the historiography of slavery, right? It pretends as if Black women didn't even really exist. And that's very, very frustrating, the ways in which Black women are marginalized and made smaller in a period of time during which they were the center, they were the focal point, and they were the sort of economic engine of this country. And so when slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment, it didn't just abolish, you know, trading in people. It abolished all badges and incidents of slavery. And so the question becomes, and the question I was sort of bandying about with Monica Simpson, is whether or not the 13th Amendment, to the extent that it abolishes badges and incidents of slavery, should also have something to say about slave breeding and about the reproductive control of Black women. I mean, that's a constitutional argument that not a lot of people have made in courts, but it's certainly one that Black scholars have been making in law review articles and the like.
And to just further get our law nerd on here, it is really exciting in the sense that constitutional jurisprudence around abortion rights is in flux right now. We spend so much time talking about the attacks on abortion rights and the undue burden standard and what that means, that by specifically centering the impact of an abortion ban on Black women and bringing race as a constitutional element into the analysis, things could change. And that's exciting because we know that this isn't an impact that's isolated to Georgia. We know that these statements are true across the country in terms of impacts on bans. And so if we can force the court to consider race as it plays out in these attacks on reproductive autonomy, I am here for it.
Absolutely here for it. And, you know, I'm not sure what this means in terms of policy, but I do know that Black women have never been able to control our reproduction. And the laws that are banning abortion now are part of a history of subjugating Black women's freedom and demonizing Black women, demonizing Black mothers, demonizing Black babies. And so I'm hoping that this lawsuit will lead to a sort of national reckoning about the ways in which anti-choicers use Black women as pawns in these wars about abortion. And frankly, the way that Black women are being treated now is not all that different from the way that Black women were treated during slavery, right? I mean, white supremacy exerted a stranglehold on Black women's reproductive freedom then, and white supremacy is still exerting a stranglehold on Black women's reproduction now. So I don't know. I'm very animated about this, as you can probably tell. I'm very excited about this new direction that the law is taking, that abortion jurisprudence is taking. But I guess the question that you, listener, are probably interested in is, what is going to happen next? Like, how is this case going to move forward?
Okay, so the litigation is in the very beginning stages. The lawsuit was filed just like something like 2 weeks ago. And the law itself isn't even set to take effect until January 1st, 2020. So first things first, the lawsuit asks the law to be blocked before that January 1st, 2020 deadline. We've got a little bit of time. The court's going to have a hearing and, like we said, should block the law. But no matter how the lower court rules, there will be an appeal because, as we've also said, the entire point of these bills is to get a court of higher authority. So that'd be an appeals court and ultimately the Supreme Court to overturn abortion rights. So in this process, though, because the complaint centers Black women, the court will have to grapple with the impact and effect these kinds of laws have on people of color specifically.
And you know what that means, Jess?
What does that mean, Imani?
It means data! Data!
Ah, Dana!
Justice Breyer, Mr. Nerdman himself, is probably going to get very excited about some of the data. And honestly, I would love to read a, you know, I don't know. I have a feeling how the 5-4 majority court is going to rule, but I would love to read a dissent from Breyer just going into the data about how these laws specifically affect Black women. Like, I would love to see that. I would also love to see a spicy as fuck dissent from Sonia Sotomayor talking about reproductive justice as a framework and just this notion that reproductive justice, that RJ, is going to make its way into abortion rights jurisprudence, that the term reproductive justice will be in a Supreme Court reporter, which, wow, that reference just really dated me because
wow,
no
yeah,
one uses
so for the kids listening, those were the books we used to use in the olden days to look up Supreme Court opinions before the interwebs.
I think we might be the last generation of law school students that had to actually do this shit using books, like check case law using books. But I'm excited to read on.
And some of those fuckers would hide books. Let's talk about that in an episode sometime.
Yeah,
anyway,
we'll
we don't need
law,
to do that.
Asshole law school student tactics someday. But, you know, the idea that the Supreme Court is going to have to reckon with this new framework, with this human rights framework, and potentially talk about reproductive justice and talk about abortion as being a human right, I find that very exciting. And I really do see a world in which Sonia Sotomayor writes a dissent that is very similar to that dissent she wrote in the Fourth Amendment case, Utah v. Strife, which a lot of people said ended up being a Black Lives Matter manifesto. I would love for her to write the Reproductive Justice Manifesto so that, you know, in a generation from now, when all this fuckery that the Republicans have done to the courts has dissipated and we're back to sort of a more even keel, you know, future Supreme Court judges, justices, future federal court judges are going to have to reckon with this. And that just makes me very, very happy. So, yeah, we're living in a shitty time when it comes to abortion rights, but there are glimmers of hope. There are people like Monica Simpson, and there are people who work with Monica Simpson, other advocates, other like reproductive justice organizations that focus on AAPI women, reproductive justice organizations that focus on Indigenous people, that focus on Latinx people. The notion that all of these groups are coming together and have decided to take a new way forward when it comes to these cases, it gives me some hope in a time where there's not a lot of hope to go around.
Absolutely. And who knows, you know, we've got a little ways out before anything like this would pipeline up to the Supreme Court. Maybe there's some changes and we could get a Sonia Sotomayor majority opinion. Who knows?
Wouldn't that be lovely? Pack the courts, man!
Pack the courts, man!
All right, that's going to do it for us today. You should follow me on Twitter. I'm Angry Black Lady. You should follow Jess on Twitter. She's Hegemommy, Hegemommy. You can follow Rewire.news at Rewire_news. And you should join our Facebook group, Boom Lawyered. Go and answer the questions. They're very short. It's very easy. If you weren't around for all of our Brad McBeer stuff, Brad McBeer, Justice Kegstand, Justice Beer Funnel, all of those things are also accurate names for him. And aside from that, we will see you on the tubes.
See you on the tubes. Boom Lawyered is created and hosted by Jessica Mason Piclo and Imani Gandhi. This episode was produced by Mark Folletti, who is also our executive producer. And the Rewire.news editor-in-chief is Jody Jacobson.